This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
Can you explain why the government has chosen not to implement the very clear recommendations made by the Chief Electoral Officer to Parliament on how to better protect electors' privacy by applying the broadly accepted privacy principles and oversight mechanism that apply to other key federal institutions? These recommendations were made by the Chief Electoral Officer after the 43rd and 44th elections. The provisions in Bill C-4 do not meet even the CEO's minimal level of protection of electors' privacy. Further, can you be clear about why the government has not implemented other important recommendations from the Chief Electoral Officer, for example, the collection of demographic information on electoral participants?
That was Senator Donna Dasko earlier this week during a Senate Committee of the Whole hearing on Bill C-4, ostensibly a bill about affordability measures, but which also includes what might be the weakest possible privacy rules for Canadian political parties. Finance Minister François-Philippe Champagne appeared before the Senate and faced repeated questions about the privacy provisions. He had, to be frank, few good answers. Indeed, when combined with Bill C-2, the border bill that also includes lawful access provisions, the government seems to have made burying anti-privacy rules in omnibus bills a core legislative strategy. To examine the importance of political party privacy and the implications of Bill C-4, I've teamed up this week with the BC Freedom of Information and Privacy Association for a joint podcast. Together with their executive director, Jason Waiwata, we recorded a conversation that touches on data and political parties, the BC litigation that seems to have sparked the federal action, and the Bill C-4 provisions. The conversation can be found on both of our podcasts, this Law Bites episode and the BC FIPPA Access and Privacy Online podcast. Thanks for having me and doing this, my podcast, for many years. I've never done a joint podcast, but I think it's a great idea. And your work in this area has been fantastic. You know, to get us started, for people that don't follow closely the issue of political parties and data, give us a sense of just how important is data to the modern political party? You know, what are they collecting and do we have a sense of how they're using it?
Yeah, and to start with that, I think it's important to draw the analogy to finances and money, because ultimately, personal information and the information that political parties can append to voter files is as important to them as a dollar bill. It informs how they allocate resources, where they move those resources across a province, across a country, and within a constituency. So that money, that personal information, is vital in that regard. It's how they inform every subsequent decision. It's how they inform who they can persuade, who they can mobilize, and what they can do to get them to the polls in order to vote on respective issues. And so that has evolved over the past number of decades, since the early 90s, in many respects, in terms of its increasing use in political organizations. And politicians are really at this nexus point of corporations. And I've come to start to see it as a political industrial complex of consultants, pollsters, corporations, labor, civil society groups, all in this milieu of people giving their information onto social media platforms, into different platforms, signing onto petitions, and that information then being used by political parties in terms of their mobilization and get out the vote campaigns and these other activities. So it really is as important to what political parties do as money, and it triggers all the same resource scarcity issues that you see in terms of how organizations react when they run into these issues of what does that dollar bill mean to them? What does it mean when I don't have somebody's phone number? I have to find a different way to contact them. What does it mean when I don't have their email? I've got to resort to cell phone numbers or door knocking, those types of things. So all those things are really important. If you want to take a look at what is being collected and how it's being collected. The most definitive document here sort of comes in from the Office of the Information and Privacy Commissioner in British Columbia. Because privacy law applies to provincial parties there, they have done an investigation report, P19-01, full disclosure, political parties, campaign data, and voter consent, dating back to February 6th of 2019. And there they have a complete list of all of the information that they identified being collected by provincial parties in British Columbia. Those can be extrapolated to the rest of Canada to sort of give you an idea of what's being collected there. We've linked to that on the FIPA website so you can take a look at it.
That's a really good rundown on just why this is so important. You know, the link between that data and the law in many respects is the question of whose law, if any, applies. You mentioned the BC and the report, and I want to get into a BC case that in many ways has sparked a reaction from the political parties. And I think it's important to know that part of the background on this is that the federal privacy commissioner has affirmed that by and large, the federal privacy law, PIPEDA, simply doesn't apply to most of the activities of a federal political party. So we've got a void in between sort of the connection between a federal political party and federal privacy law, which brings us to BC. Can we talk a bit about the role that BC law applies here, and in particular, a BC case that has clearly lit a fire under the federal political parties and the government to try to, in a sense, stop it from proceeding?
Sure. And what's occurred here is because PIPEDA is silent on federal political parties, it doesn't apply to them. What was happening in British Columbia is because PIPEDA there is substantively similar, and it includes political parties, complainants came forward and said, well, if this applies to political parties in British Columbia, that includes federal political parties. And those complaints moved through the OIPC process, judicial review, and ended up in the Supreme Court. And the rulings there have consistently been that BC privacy law applies because it is one of those pieces that should apply given the Elections Act is silent, PIPEDA is silent, and BC has substantively similar laws. And so this has been working its way through the court system. That case was meant to go forward through the Court of Appeal this spring. But there's been other things that have consistently led to delays in this coming forward in terms of delivering justice as well. There have been multiple laws introduced at the federal level that have attempted to try and remove the ability of BC to have its law apply and say that other privacy laws might apply. We've seen a real mishmash of arguments coming forward from political parties where they're saying PIPA applies in public, and yet the privacy commissioner is making it very clear PIPA doesn't apply. And so there's been this real back and forth in terms of political parties and how they manage that personal information. And that's why the case has sort of continued to move forward at a very glacial rate in many respects. It was slated to go forward on the 23rd. And then this week we see sort of Bill C-4 coming forward and these amendments. And that's really one of the things that's given pause there. And the latest discussion is that given the introduction of these new federal laws, that the case should be delayed until those laws are passed or work their way through the current session. And they are considered by the courts in totality in that respect. So that's where things are sitting right now. And, you know, we've got some really good, we're really pleased to be working with Wulfis Van Aert in terms of our pro bono counsel to intervene in that case. And there's been some really good work being done by the complainants and their legal counsel to bring forward this matter and continue pressing federal political parties to try and adhere to some form of privacy law across in British Columbia specifically, but also come to terms and reconcile what they're doing with privacy law across the country. The next question that comes up for us is, as we look at where the cases are all moving forward and this introduction of federal law, I think the question comes forward from us to you, Michael, as a legal professor and an expert in this area. You know, C-4 is just the latest attempt. Before that, we understand there was C-65. That didn't move forward. What happened with C-65 and how is it different than C-4?
Yeah, no, those are great questions. And you're right that, you know, what we've seen is the federal government supported, it should be noted, certainly by the conservatives. So we've got the two largest parties that are on side on this, seeking to try to stop exactly the kind of litigation that you just described. And it started with Bill C-65, which was a piece of legislation to reform the Elections Act last year, back in 2024. It included a whole range of different reforms to the Elections Act. But on the privacy side, it sought to, first and foremost, replace or make clear that provincial privacy laws would not apply to the federal parties. The goal was to say federal government is stepping in and that if PIPEDA doesn't apply, well, then the Elections Act will apply. And within Bill C-65, it included the privacy provisions that would apply to federal political parties. And the problem with it, and the concern, I think, for many in the privacy community, and certainly those that follow these issues, is that the expectations that were being set for political parties was far lower than what you would typically find for the private sector. So government asking the private sector to do a series of things, facing significant penalties if they fail to do so, but not coming even close to the same kinds of requirements for itself or for its own parties. And the primary focus of how C-65 tried to deal with it was really, they would say, through a privacy policy. I mean, this is sort of back to the future. It's kind of the way people thought of privacy protection 20 years ago. They said, well, what you really need is a privacy policy. And so here, there was a requirement to have a privacy policy, designate a privacy officer, include contact information, describe what information was being collected, used and disclosed, provide some illustrative examples, talk about the training that was being used within the party around some of these issues. So, you know, there were a series of issues. You had to keep it secure, of course. There were a couple of more notable provisions, as I'll note in a moment, they've disappeared. One involved security breaches. So what happens if the data itself is subject of a breach and is lost? What steps would they have to take? And there were some restrictions, notably a restriction on selling that data. So there were some provisions in there, but it was by and large focused on a privacy policy kind of model. The penalties were very limited. There are AMPs, administrative monetary penalties available for violations. The max is $5,000. By comparison, the max for proposed privacy reform legislation was $10 million, or 3% of global revenues, $5,000 versus $10 million in terms of sort of the penalties associated with it. So that was C-65, but the bill never went anywhere. It went through a couple of readings in the House. It never even made it to committee, much less getting out of the House of Commons, and so it died. I think to the surprise of many, as the government moved quickly, literally in its first week of substantive legislation, it moved first with Bill C-2, which included at the end, as you talked about last week, lawful access provisions, and included in C-4 an affordability measures bill, tax reform, carbon tax related issues, included many of the same provisions that we saw in Bill C-65. I mean, it was, you know, one of these things just doesn't belong. And it was quite clearly these Election Act related provisions. There are some modest changes for the worse in the Bill C-4 version, in the version that is before the House right now. And so the security breach provisions have been removed. The restrictions on not being able to sell data has been removed. But by and large, it's the same thing, because in some ways the goal is the same. And that is largely to find a mechanism to stop the BC case that we've been discussing from proceeding.
And are there other elements that really leap out to you in terms of what's been cut from C-65? Has it moved into C-4, or are those sort of the highest ones? Because we've been really struck, I mean, generally, the lack of any of the application of the privacy principles that we see from PIPEDA anywhere in this legislation. And it seems as though that's really been reduced even more with C-4.
It has. As I mentioned, there are a couple of core parts elements there that have been removed. And I think security breach is a really important one. I think, you know, the expectation that organizations are required to disclose a breach to those who are affected has become an important part of privacy laws around the world, including here in Canada. Removing that from this means that you could have a party that could knowingly suffer a breach and frankly not have to tell anybody about it. It's pretty shocking. But by and large, I mean, what's notable here is just how weak all of these provisions are. In fact, you know, I think we'll get into it when the government has tried to defend it, and they've largely tried to avoid talking about these provisions. But when they have been forced to try to defend it at the Senate, they've readily acknowledged that it's not particularly strong, that many people might take a look at this and say, hey, you know, you ought to do better when it comes to privacy protections. And these are the rules that they are setting for themselves. And I haven't mentioned it, but I think it's critical to reference. Not only is this weak, but they have set this rule that these particular changes, that they will be retroactive to the year 2000. I mean, you couldn't make this up. I mean, they're literally saying that these provisions are the provisions that should have been in effect dating back 25 years. And so they are, through this legislation, saying that's what we determine has taken place here. We're going to make this retroactive all the way back to the year 2000, which in effect removes any potential liability over decades. Any privacy violation that might have taken place over the last 25 years is just suddenly wiped out.
Well, I mean, the irony to me in that is the political jeopardy they place themselves in that any data breach that affects a Canadian since the year 2000 is now the responsibility of the federal political parties, because they've had no responsibility to report a data breach. And so if your personal information is now out there on the dark web, you can sit there and literally say, well, it's the fault of the federal political parties because they've had no reporting responsibility. They've had nothing that requires that they substantiate that they haven't had a data breach. And as a member of the public, they've got access to all this information. And so if it's suddenly out there on the dark web or out there and impacting me as an individual, there's nothing that allows me to trust that it wasn't the political parties that had that data breach through bad actions or mismanagement. And the irony in that to me is very, very strong, because they're doing this to try and alleviate the risk that they face, and yet they are inherently increasing it. Because the other thing that happens is if a corporation is now accused of being subject of a data breach, now it wasn't us, it must have been somebody else. Well, who else could it have been? And the only other sector in Canada that isn't required to do breach reporting in many respects now, and it gets this sort of blank check, are the federal political parties. So that's been one of the things as I've been wrapping my head around this issue in terms of the implications of C4 and that breach reporting that's important. I was really struck by the lack of openness or transparency under, you know, PIPEDA 8 and individual access on PIPEDA 9 in terms of those core principles, because we're an access organization as well as a privacy organization. The fact that they're going to use a representative sample of the information they collect means that there's going to be outliers in terms of that. They may have more information about you, but you don't have the right to know that. They also aren't giving you the right to go in and correct information. And when you go in and take a look at their privacy policies right now, they say that you have the ability to correct information if you submit it to them, but they are under no legal obligation to act on those corrections that you send to them. And you certainly don't have the right to know what you are correcting or what they have that requires correction. And those to me are really important principles in PIPEDA and privacy policies and standards writ large that we see federal political parties just saying, no, it's not us. It doesn't apply to us. That's been troubling, I think, from our perspective as well. When I look at this, you know, when we consider how quickly this is moving, I mean, that's one of the things that struck us is the communication on this and where it's moving and how quickly it's moved. You know, it's literally another measure, not even named in the bill's title. And it sure looks like they're trying to move this as quickly through Parliament as possible. What are we seeing play out in terms of the timing with this advancing and the procedures that are taking place with this?
Yeah, no, I'm glad you asked, because that to me has been one of the really troubling things as well. I mean, you've highlighted some of the shortcomings. At the end of the day, we're not talking about real privacy legislation in the way that almost anybody would conceive it, certainly not in the way that the government itself has conceived it when it talks about privacy legislation for everyone else. You know, it's do as I say, not as I do when it comes to privacy with respect to the political parties. But their approach here has been just enormously problematic. You know, we're talking about a government that when it was in opposition, it's been a while now, consistently criticized the use of omnibus legislation to try to pack together a whole series of different things in the hope that it kind of just would slide through. And in this instance, they really were clearly hoping that the privacy-related provisions would simply slide through. It was, as you mentioned, included in a bill that had absolutely nothing to do with any of these issues. It was not a focal point of discussion in terms of the briefing materials. And I think most notably, when there has been debate on this bill, on Bill C-4 in the House of Commons, the Liberal MPs, members of Parliament, the minister, does not talk about this part of the legislation at all. The sort of the maiden speech from, in this case, it's the finance minister, François-Philippe Champagne, did not mention the privacy-related elements here at all when he spoke about it in the House. When Liberal MPs had the chance to debate this legislation at second reading, they didn't mention it. The only MP that did was a new Conservative MP, Stephen Bonk, who used his time to focus very much on this and talking about how this approach would really undermine trust, transparency in the political system at the very time when these things are under threat. And, you know, in some ways, he was going against some of the perspectives we've seen from some of his colleagues who, by and large, have tried to steer clear of this or have tried to argue that, well, we're just trying to provide a bit of clarity and we think there should be a single privacy system and it ought to come out of the federal government. Yet, of course, unspoken here is that the federal privacy law doesn't apply in most of these circumstances, and they're trying to propose something, or they are proposing something that doesn't come even close to what we would think of from a privacy perspective. So the government introduces this. It seems to want to slide it by. In fact, one of the more remarkable things associated with this as well has been the charter statement that came with this legislation. So the government for many years now has required the Department of Justice to put forward a charter statement to talk about the compatibility of proposed legislation with the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And, you know, we were talking earlier about Bill C-65. If you look at the charter statement for Bill C-65, it actively engages with the privacy-related implications of the legislation. And the implications there went beyond just political parties, but there's fulsome discussion about what this means from a political party perspective and what that would then mean from a charter perspective. Remarkably, they've put out, the Department of Justice puts out very quickly a charter statement for Bill C-4, and it says there are no charter effects. So suddenly, many of the similar provisions that were introduced just a year ago that had charter effects, suddenly now the Department of Justice can't find any charter effects. And somehow privacy itself doesn't have a charter effect. It is, it shows just, you know, how degraded the whole charter statement process has become. And in this instance, it's pretty stunning to see this reversal really in the span of a year. Now, I should mention that there has been now one opportunity to really question the government on all of this. And this is in some ways a bit of a both a good news and bad news situation. And so where this came from was in the Senate, which decided that they would do a pre-study of the bill. Senate does that from time to time where they anticipate the bill will make it to the Senate. And so they conduct a hearing on it in advance of the legislation coming forward, and so that way they can speed up the process. I think they put that forward at the time, hoping that this legislation would pass before the summer, although I don't think that's going to happen. But in the case of the C-4 hearing, what they decided to do was rather than send it to a committee for study where you'd bring in a lot of witnesses, they said they would conduct this study with the full Senate, and the minister would come and he would be forced to respond to questions from all senators on this legislation on C-4. And to me, it's quite notable that on a bill, as we've been saying, that focused primarily on affordability measures, there were quite a few senators that wanted to talk about the privacy elements of this bill. Senator Dasko, Senator Simon, Senator Deakin, Senator Wallen, they were all senators that in the past have focused on privacy-related issues, and they were very concerned with this legislation. And I have to say that Minister Champagne just had no good answers. You know, his emphasis was on clarity and certainty, and that maybe you could argue that there are stronger rules and maybe they should think about stronger rules, but they're moving ahead with this. And he kept saying that there was unanimous support for this legislation in the House. There's not even been a vote on this legislation beyond just second reading. And so there was support for sending it to committee. The idea that that means there's unanimous support for this legislation in its current form is being disingenuous, to say the least. He also emphasized the penalties. He kept saying, you know, listen, there are administrative and monetary penalties associated with this legislation. But as I mentioned earlier, consistent with C-65, those amps, those penalties, are a maximum of $5,000. This is, just change in somebody's pocket relative to the money that we're talking about, and in comparison to the millions and millions of dollars that the government has said is necessary in other privacy rules, it's stunning for, frankly, a minister to somehow suggest that these are real penalties that would actually have some sort of bite and impact.
Yeah. I mean, in all of our communications with the MPs and the senators on this, we've attempted to stress that this impacts on them as well, because having worked in politics and knowing a number of people who do, the substantive opposition research files that are created on individuals and on members in your own party at times are beyond what you see in the general electorate. And those packages of information have far-reaching implications to the elected individuals. And so this impacts them as well as the general public. And we've been trying to make sure that they are aware of that, that this isn't some, you know, issue that affects the vast majority of the population and not them, because it impacts them quite directly. And it's been interesting to see, Senators Wallen and Dasko in particular raising the whole fox in the chicken coop type of scenario here, where the political parties are in a conflict of interest here. And the comparison I keep going to is in boundary redistribution and some of these other things, where they recognize their inherent conflicts of interest to act in their own best interests rather than the interests of the electorate. And they divorce themselves from those decisions in a particular way by aligning themselves within the Elections Act and secondary acts to supplement and avoid those conflicts of interest. And here, they're leaning straight into the fact that they want unilateral control of that personal information as much as they can without recognizing that inherent conflict. And they're going to continue to run into, I think, a lot of opposition until they reconcile and recognize that conflict and take appropriate steps. Because what I keep going back to with this is those privacy standards back in the mid-90s, right? The CSA standards that have been echoed through every piece of privacy legislation in Canada and internationally and around the world from OECD and other areas. And the absence of those applying to the federal political parties here is glaringly obvious for anyone that's studied in this area and really important to try and reconcile. And the Election Act doesn't cut it without substantial amendments, and those aren't evidenced here. So, you know, I think one of the other things that we wanted to make sure we touched on with this is, you know, some of the next steps and sort of what's taking place here. But when we're recording this the morning of June 20th, you know, where does this bill stand now? And what I've been hearing from people, I understood this was going to pass. Now I'm here, it might not. What are you aware of right now, Michael, in terms of where this is sitting?
Yeah, no, I think the government's initial hope was that this would become law before the summer. In fact, the government was pretty ambitious, Mr. Carney, thinking that they could put forward really three bills. I think there was some hope on their end that they could move forward with bills C2, C4, and C5. And you talked about C2, that includes lawful access provisions last week. We're talking now about C4. C5, of course, is the national projects bill that has itself become quite controversial. At this stage, as we record this, it would appear that only C5 is going to pass. And there has been a full court press from within the government and in the Senate to get that legislation through before the summer. But in the case of the other legislation at this stage, it seems pretty clear that it will not pass. And so, you know, I think that they may have bitten off more than they could chew in terms of trying to get all three of those bills through. C2 and the lawful access provisions are really creating a wake-up call, I think, for a lot of people. This is the breadth of warrantless access to information is positively stunning and incredibly troubling, and I think is going to be the subject of a lot of debate over the summer and into the fall. And you know, as we talk about this and the implications of creating a framework that would both stop the litigation that we talked about in BC, but then also create a real void in terms of the of having strong rules with real penalties with respect to political parties on data that can be highly sensitive. One would hope that this will attract attention too. The challenge is going to be, and I think you highlighted it, is the referenced by the senators, the idea of the fox in the chicken coop, and the challenge of political parties that really at the end of the day face a bit of a conflict here because they want to be able to use the data with as few restrictions as possible, and the public interest gets lost in the process. In fact, it is worth noting that this is hardly the first time we've seen this play out. We have anti-spam legislation. We have do not call legislation. And in each of those instances, political parties have exempted themselves from the requirements of both spam and do not call. In fact, we know that just over the last week or so, the CRTC provided its semi-annual review of the complaints that it gets under the Canada's anti-spam legislation, and political parties were by far the largest source of SMS-based spam during that period, which the CRTC noted doesn't, the anti-spam legislation doesn't apply to that activity. So there is a history of exempting themselves here. One would hope that the senators are less beholden to the parties and that they may speak out, but there are, I think, real concerns. Perhaps down the road, we might see efforts to reform PIPEDA so that it covers them, or efforts to reform the Elections Act. But you know, given the past precedent, it's hard to be optimistic. And I think in many ways, that's really going to require strong efforts from those who are concerned about privacy, which in some ways leads me to want to ask you a question. On the assumption that this doesn't pass before the summer, and that there are now several months to try to galvanize members, try to galvanize the public around this issue. What are the kinds of things that you're thinking about doing when it comes to this issue and perhaps privacy more broadly?
Yeah, and I think it's important to recognize a few things that we've been doing with some of that work and the broader sector as well, because we can't do this type of work alone. It's going to require a lot of many hands make light work, is the motto that I've been reminded of in these areas. And so what we've been trying to do is make sure that people have as much information as possible to exercise their privacy rights and understand what those are with political organizations specifically. Part of our work with that has meant that we've built on our website an entire reference section that does an interprovincial scan across Canada that looks at the Elections Act and your different rights to personal information and privacy in the different jurisdictions across Canada. So we've got your political privacy on our Get Help section of our website to sort of help people navigate that. I think we need to do a line-by-line comparison of this act and understand exactly what that means and what all of these amendments could prospectively mean, and really do a deeper dive on that and make sure people are aware. And then it's going to be a lot of old school communications, making sure people are aware, making sure that the MPs and the senators are aware on this matter, and getting the information to them so they can make an informed decision. Working with people like you, legal experts that understand this stuff and can give them the information, and recognizing as well that that there are people who have worked in this space that are aware of the inherent conflict of interest, are aware of the distinctions of political parties to engage with the population for the purposes of communication, and that that is distinct from a corporate interest or a government interest. And there needs to be nuances in legislation and regulation to account for that. And that it would be disingenuous to say that PIPEDA should apply without modification or distinctions for political parties, because I think it does require some accommodation. But there needs to be recognition that those principles are there for a reason. And they were part of the consultation that gave rise to the privacy principles in the 90s. So if we're looking at proto-laws and those types of dynamics, there's important considerations there. So I think that's one of the things to keep in mind with this. I think, you know, making sure that people are more aware of this, getting more information into the hands of the public so they know how to exercise their rights is going to be important. I want to make sure we end with a consideration from you on this. Where do you see, as a professor and privacy expert across Canada, what do you think civil society needs to do and people need to keep in mind?
Yeah, well, I think it starts with awareness. And, you know, I think I'm grateful for the efforts of many of the groups out there that are trying to at least educate and ensure that there is awareness of these issues. I think there's a reason that I think we've seen the government try to slip in lawful access in C2 and these Elections Act reforms in C4 at the very end of something without giving it a whole lot of publicity. And that is because I think they know that this is legislation that would not enjoy wide support or be particularly popular if there was awareness about it. And so I think that the first step is making sure that the people are aware of the full implications of this, that they make sure that their members of parliament are aware of it as well, and the government is forced to defend it, and that we need, in the case of lawful access, I think wholesale reforms. I think it ought to be removed altogether. Well, I think both really ought to be removed, but there needs to be, I think, robust debate. I think, you know, it's hard to make a credible argument if you're government about why these provisions are in these bills to begin with. And, you know, it's one thing to sort of say, hey, we want to make changes to the Elections Act and privacy rules, or we want to bring in lawful access. And I think we could have a robust debate about both of those, but we ought to have a debate about them in their own bill, not through the back door, so to speak, in the way that this is happening. So, you know, I think the starting point is recognizing that, you know, in many ways, government is hoping that people will not be paying attention on this. I mean, I think that's why it's in the legislation in the way that it is. That's why they've introduced this way. Some ways, there's an opportunity here. The fact that it did not pass or is unlikely to pass before the summer break means that there are a number of months for people to become more aware of it. And I think the more they hear about it, the more they're going to take a look and ask, you know, why is this here? And I've got concerns about some of the approaches that are being taken. And we don't yet know how this government is going to respond to proposed changes. Perhaps this government will not see improving bills as a weakness, as we've seen in the past, frankly, from both parties, and may be open to some change. It's hard to be optimistic, but in some ways we've been given, for those that are concerned with this, the gift of some time now, which means that I think this really needs to be a focal point. In many ways, that's why I was so happy that we were able to come together and record this together. So I want to thank you for the conversation. I'm grateful we're able to do it in this way.
Great. Hopefully we've been able to contribute something, and this was a lot of fun. Really appreciated the opportunity as well.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter at lawbitespod, or follow Michael Geist at mgeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca, or subscribe at iTunes, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo Lebron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose Lebron LeBoy. Credit information for clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.